Case number 13-5315, Ross Corporation Appellant v. Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States et al. Mr. Clement for the appellant, Mr. Letter for the appellees.
Good morning, Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Paul Clement for the appellants. The District Court erred in its due process ruling and in dismissing appellant's CFIUS claims as moot. The government, for its part, contends that the District Court erred in even reaching the due process issues because of the preclusion in the statute for judicial review. But we find it well established in this Court's cases and in the Supreme Court's cases that there's a presumption in favor of the review of constitutional questions, whether as applied or facial. And so we think, if anything, the fact that there are limits on the post-deprivation judicial remedies actually makes it more important, not less important, that the executive process comply with the Constitution. Now, on the merits of the due process analysis, we think the starting point is whether there's a protected property interest or a liberty interest. And we think it's quite clear that there's a property interest here because it's actually, as I understand, conceded, certainly the District Court took it as conceded, that there was a state law property interest at issue here, that my client has state law property interest. And, of course, that's backed up by the actual reality on the ground. If you consider the situation before the CFIUS action and the President's action, my clients had full access to this property. They could develop the property. They could come and go as they please. And then after the CFIUS, this federal action, and then the President's action, they couldn't even go onto the property. They were ordered to destroy things on the property, and they were told that they could not transfer the property to another party, including a United States citizen, without prior approval of the federal government.
So, the District Court seemed to give great weight to a purported concession that was made at oral argument that undermined the property interest claim when counsel said in response to a question something to the effect, I think my argument would be the same whether this was, whether we had gone to CFIUS before we bought the property or after we bought the property. And the government makes a lot of hay from that in their brief by saying that there really isn't a property interest here. What's your response? I think I know what your response is, but what's your response?
Yeah, my response is that really mixes apples and oranges, and I think in terms of thinking about the due process analysis, you have to start with whether there's a protected property interest, and then you assess whether the procedures are adequate. And so I think to say that because we would say that the procedures here would be inadequate even if we had only a liberty interest in acquiring the property, that somehow means we don't have property, I think is just wrong. And so I think here it's clear that we have the property interest. I think it is also clear that the procedures that were afforded here are woefully inadequate. And I think all that counsel meant before the District Court was when you have procedures like this, we'd have the same beef with these procedures being inadequate, even if we were earlier in the process and only had a liberty interest to assert. But I think at the end of the day, the analysis has to confront the facts of this case. And I think the starting point, as I suggested, is that there is a property interest. It was essentially obliterated by federal action. Now, that federal action may be valid, it may be invalid, but the idea that that federal action is somehow immune from due process analysis, man, with all due respect, I find that kind of mystifying. So then if I could turn then to the procedures, I think that the procedures here, in our view, clearly are inadequate, certainly inadequate as to a property interest. As indicated, we would say they're inadequate even as to a liberty interest.
Well, one of the things that we've asked the government is whether there are any unclassified materials that support the president's reasoning here. So one question is, if there are none, if everything is based on classified materials, does that do anything to your due process claim? Is it satisfied at that point?
Well, it starts to satisfy. I would argue that it doesn't exhaust our due process argument at all. I mean, I think we'd still have a substantial due process argument. You know, ultimately, the questions that arise if there's nothing in terms of the evidence that the government can give that's unclassified, I mean, I think this court has recognized that that raises a more difficult due process issue at the end of the day. But I don't think that even in a situation where there's only classified information, evidence at stake, That doesn't mean that the government can't do more to satisfy due process than they've done here or that they suggest that they have an obligation to do. And I think what we really, you know, would request at a minimum is the idea that we get notice of the actions that the government thinks that we're going to undertake that threaten national security. And I think it would also be appropriate for the government, if at all, if appropriate, to identify the specific factors in F of the statute that they think are implicated by the transaction. And I think if we had those things, we'd at least have a target to shoot at. And I think when you start applying the Matthews v. Eldridge balancing test here, I think the reason that that balancing test goes so strongly against the government here is, given what they've afforded here, which is essentially nothing, it's entirely possible that they could block a foreign investment transaction based on a mistaken factual premise. I mean, in a case like this, we're still in the dark as to the basic beef here that the government has. And if you look at the 11 factors that are articulated in subsection F of the statute, some of them go to energy infrastructure. Now, if the concerns implicated the fact that these are wind farms and they generate energy, then Rawls, which is in the business of acquiring properties to provide wind farms, has a general problem. And they would, I think, have a fair interest in trying to figure out, okay, are we just done here? Are you just going to block every one of these transactions? Conversely, if there's something very specific about the Oregon site that is the gravamen of their concerns, A, we don't really know what that was, but B, there might have been a way to address that. Again, you know, one of these farms is in restricted airspace, one of the properties, three of them are not. There would have been a possibility of a back and forth about potential mitigation, if that's the nature of their concern. But all this has a very abstract quality for us, because without knowing even the basic gravamen of their concerns, and again, I think, you know, the government tries to get as much as they can, and I understand that, you know, national security, ultimately there's a component of this that's going to be within the executive's discretion. But if you look at the statute here and you look at those 11 factors that are enumerated, some of them are quite specific. Most of them actually seem directed to what I take to be what Congress really had its focus on here, which is really not our case, which is a situation where some foreign company is going to take over, you know, Lockheed Martin or something, and all of a sudden a defense contractor is going to be owned by a foreign enterprise. So this is all, you know, and I'm not saying at the end of the day that this means that it's invalid. I'm just saying I think this is a somewhat unorthodox use of this statute, and therefore I think due process requires us to get, as it would in a mine run use of the statute, but just the basic gravamen of their concern so that we can address it. If there is unclassified information, evidence, then we could perhaps address that as well. And as I said, I think at the end of the day, there is a possibility through that kind of procedure for us to help the government correct an erroneous factual premise. And then if you think about, we don't mean to suggest that there aren't weighty government concerns that go into the Matthews balancing.
Well, let me ask you about those weighty government concerns, because you said this is an unorthodox use. According to a 2012 CFIUS annual report to Congress, of 538 covered transactions between 2008 and 2012, this is the only one that resulted in a presidential order.
That's right, Judge Henderson. I think what those numbers don't capture is the fact that in a lot of these...
I mean, it may be an unorthodox use, but there may be a reason for that.
There may well be, and we just don't know whether it is, and we've had no opportunity to test that even before the executive in any meaningful way, and that's all that we're really looking for here. What I would say, though, just to keep those numbers in perspective, is there are transactions where, and I think this is more likely if you're just in a proposed transaction situation, where if you go through that process and it looks like CFIUS is not going to approve it, then you essentially abandon the project before you get to the presidential step. So I don't think that it's right to infer from that only one transaction has been discontinued because of this overall statutory regime. I think that it's certainly possible to either enter a mitigation arrangement with CFIUS, or, again, if it's a proposed transaction, it's a little easier to walk away from it.
Can I ask you about the presentation you made to the committee in June of 2012? Were you responding to anything, or did you just make the presentation without any idea of what the committee might have been worried about?
Well, I think we answered, principally it was our presentation, our opportunity to make a presentation. There were some specific questions, you know, from the questions, you know, I don't think we were able to infer what the gravamen of their concerns were, and that is really, I think, what we're looking for. And if you look at the way the statute and the regulations, it's a very odd dynamic because, you know, usually you think about notice coming from the government about what's bothering the government. Here, the only notice referred to in the statute is the notice that the regulated party provides to the government. It says we have notice of either this proposed transaction or this completed transaction, and we'd like to get essentially your blessing for it so we can get the benefit of the safe harbor under the statute. So it's a very odd structure, but I would suggest that notwithstanding the oddity of the structure, that doesn't mean you don't have to comply with due process if you're the government. And again, I don't think we're asking for, you know, the stars and the moon here. I think we're asking for, I think we would like the unclassified evidence and an opportunity to respond to it. We'd also like notice of the basic gravamen of the government's actions so that we can respond to that and potentially correct any factual premises, mistakes that may underlie that. And it does seem to me that, in a sense, there's a little bit of a challenge for the due process analysis here because what the government has offered is nothing. I mean, you know, in looking at this court's cases, it actually reminded me of the Unger case where that was a trading with the enemy context case. But there, the Justice Department essentially offered no process, no opportunity for the party.
But the government argues in their brief that there were, you know, phone conversations, there were meetings during the CFIUS process, not, I guess, necessarily once they referred the matter to the president, in that there was interaction, there was back and forth, there was information that was provided, and they say that it's significant that they're the ones who kind of brought the issue to your client's attention in the first place and invited your client to make an application. And so I guess their point is that you were placed on notice of potential issues.
Sure, and well said, potential issues. But if you don't know what the real issues are, then, you know, I think there's a reason that the court's cases always talk about notice and an opportunity to be heard. Because if you have an opportunity to be heard without meaningful notice, I mean, you can have a court reporter, you can make it as formal as you want, but a hearing where you come in just with an opportunity to potentially respond to whatever's on the government's mind, but you don't know what's on the government's mind, I think is, you know, it certainly does not satisfy due process. And what we were put on notification of is their sense that this was a covered transaction. But that sort of the action in the statute, if you will, at the end of the day, because there are every day in this country, there are covered transactions. There's billions of dollars in foreign direct investment, most of which never really goes through the CFIUS process. They consider a relatively small chunk of the overall total. We don't have specific statistics on exactly what percentage. And so to make that process meaningful, you need notice of what's bothering them. And I do think, you know, this would be a very different case if the government said there's going to be no foreign investment in this country without our prior approval. But that's not the regime that the government has. It's not the regime that the government wants. And the government wants to project to our trading partners and everybody else that actually foreign investment is welcome in this country, and we are going to block transactions very rarely, and we're going to only give the president the authority to do it based on credible evidence that the party is going to take actions that threaten national security. And so it seems to us that at a minimum, if you're going to exercise that blocking authority, you need to give notice of, as we suggested, the unclassified evidence, the what actions you think we're going to take. The ultimate question of whether those actions implicate national security, that's not what we're looking to second guess. But and I think, you know, this case really well illustrates it, because to this day you can look at all this case and you can sort of have theories about what made this the needle in the haystack, what made this the one transaction that was worth having the president block. But I don't know what it was, and it may be that the whole thing is based on a mistaken factual premise. It may be that there would have been, if we'd known actually what was bothering, there may have been an opportunity to have them inspect the property and determine whether or not the factual basis for their concern was accurate or not.
Let me ask you a procedural question, which is whether we can consider anything outside of the four corners of your complaint with respect to kind of what procedures were actually given you in this case, because there's this affidavit that's in the record. You say in your brief that we shouldn't consider that. Is there anything outside of the complaint that we can consider, or is it your position that it's just within the four corners of the complaint?
Well, I mean, we lost this on a motion to dismiss. So as a procedural matter, we don't think you should look outside of the complaint. Now, at the end of the day, you know, we don't think anything that's adverted to in those affidavits, even if it were procedurally reachable, we don't think it makes a difference. And again, it gets back to this point that an opportunity to be heard without notice is meaningful, and that's why you start with the notice and then the opportunity to be heard. If I could just say a minute on sure. The capable of repetition, unit evading review part of the case.
Yeah, I'm getting to that because I want to ask about that.
Yes. So, you know, we think that as to the evading review part of the test, we think that the district court's analysis is really indefensible, and we think the best evidence of that is that the government doesn't defend it. I think it's well established in this court's cases that if the process takes less than 2 years, it's within the evading review, and the fact that you didn't rush into court at the first instance does not make a difference, as long as even if you'd gone in the first instance,
but
you don't hit the 2-year clock.
Didn't your client have a responsibility to file for review earlier? Then that problem wouldn't arise.
Well, it would, Your Honor, and I think that's the critical thing, because the test at the end of the day is whether or not the challenge would evade review, and review includes the appellate process. And the reason I don't think the government argues this is because you have a procedure that starts as a 30-day sort of process, intake process, 45-day investigation, and then 15 days for the president to act. So what happened here, there's basically 90 days at issue. And so somebody in our position could come in on the first day, they could come in on the 89th day, and either way, there's no way for the appellate process to run its course, and that's what matters at the end of the day. And this Court's cases are consistent with this, and they're really, you know, the Del Monte case, as we suggest in our reply brief, is on all fours in the sense that there you had somebody who sought some preliminary relief and then dropped the preliminary relief but still was able to satisfy the evading review part of the test. And then on capable of repetition, the government certainly defends the analysis there, but we think that the government has in their brief this phrase identical action, which is in quotes, but it's not quoted from anywhere. And that's because it's not the test. The test is whether you're going to be subjected to the same basic rules and regulations in agency action. And we think there's no question that we will. A company that the government considers controlled by foreign interests. It's in the business of acquiring wind farm properties like this. They may be able to acquire them in some contexts where it's not a covered transaction. They just buy the property. But there are certainly going to be other opportunities like this where they buy an ongoing enterprise and will be subjected to these same regulations. And I don't think I don't think the government's here to tell you that in these future transactions that my clients are going to get any different process. And the CFIUS process has the same basic defects as the due process claim that we brought against the president's action, which there too, there's just no indication of what the target, what the targeted action is, what they're focused on, what our focus should be on. And, you know, and I do think that's a serious problem in light of the way that CFIUS orders work. They're clearly final agency action. They are enforceable by civil penalties, and the government makes that clear in no uncertain terms. So those clearly have to comply with due process as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll give you a couple of minutes in reply.
Thank you.
Mr. Leder?
May it please the Court. Douglas Leder from the United States Department of Justice. I apologize. I have either allergies or a cold or both, and so I don't sound too good. With me today at council table, we have Sonia McNeil and Joel McElvain, both of the Civil Division of the Justice Department. I'd like to address several of the important points that my friend, Mr. Clement, made. But before doing that, I hope that I can make sure to focus the Court's attention on what specifically is involved here. Mr. Clement's argument, and this is clear from both his district court papers and the Court of Appeals papers, is that what happened before CFIUS, before the committee, as far as process, isn't relevant. That's not the key. Remember that what Mr. Clement is asking for here is access to the President of the United States, because remember, this is a decision that is made by the President personally in a 15-day window. So Mr. Clement is arguing that the Constitution guarantees his clients to Chinese business executives access to the President of the United States and an explanation from the President, not CFIUS, an explanation from the President about what he is thinking. So this is truly...
Well, now, is that your answer to our order about the classified versus unclassified?
No, Your Honor, I'll be happy to answer that.
Okay.
Let me first state, because this case went forward on motion to dismiss and the Court stayed discovery, there is no record on what, you know, the judge has asked. But since you asked, there is, I'm informed that what went to the President contains both unclassified and classified information.
All right.
Now, I just want to hasten to add one point. Even on the unclassified information, the classified information clearly wouldn't be turned over. And I think Mr. Clement was saying he's not seeking access to that. But even the unclassified, we need a remand to district court to determine whether that material would be available to Mr. Clement, because it very well could be covered by privileges, such as, you know, the presidential communications privilege. Because, again, remember what Mr. Clement is asking for is, he's, I don't care about CFIUS, I don't care about the process before the committee. I'm focusing on the decision maker, the President himself.
But aren't there two claims? I mean, isn't there a claim that we are entitled to procedural due process during the portion of the time period when CFIUS is considering what to do, and then we're also entitled to procedural due process after they make their recommendation or submit the matter to the President? Aren't those two different things, even if they lose on the second one, as long as we find that it's not moot? Isn't there a live claim as to the first? Because they would say, you know, if we could respond then, that would, you know, affect what goes to the President and could potentially change the outcome.
Your Honor, I did not understand Mr. Clement's claim at this point to be a process one involving CFIUS, but I may be wrong about that. As the district court found, that part is, we think, clearly moot, and I can get to that, you know, whenever Your Honor wishes. But so this part of the case, I believe, Mr. Clement is focusing on, my clients are entitled to due process from the President of the United States. So Mr. Clement said, we're not asking for the moon and the stars. Actually, he is. This is something that you just, I'm not aware of any court order, any court ever, that has come close to issuing the kind of order that Mr. Clement is requesting with regard to the President here.
What did, refresh my memory, what was requested in El Shifa? Because that was a presidential decision.
Yes, Your Honor. So the in-bank decision in El Shifa was that...
What did they want?
They wanted, and remember, that was the President had ordered a missile strike against a facility in Sudan. And my memory is that they wanted review under the Administrative Procedure Act of certain things that the agency was saying about what had happened. And I think they wanted a retraction also, as I recall,
right,
of statements by, I think it was the President and various officials.
That's right.
And this court held not justiciable, which the Federal Circuit had previously also held, so both courts, and it was in bank.
I can understand that you don't want the president to have to submit to a deposition.
Yeah.
But does the government have any interest in not disclosing the unclassified reasons for the president's actions?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, yes, we do. As I said, it may very well be, and this is not because we haven't had to face it yet, the executive. Remember, the president is the one who determines whether presidential communications privilege would be invoked. But certainly, if somebody came in and said, I want to know what actually went to the president, I want to know what was put on his desk, there certainly could be a strong argument that that is covered by a privilege. Whether the executive would actually invoke it here would be a question for remand. We don't think there should be any remand. We think the district court properly determined the issues, so there shouldn't be any discovery. And so, Your Honor, we'd have to see. But the main thing is, for the various arguments that Judge Jackson accepted, we don't think there's any reason at all for the court to get into this. For example, Mr. Clement mentioned the liberty interest. As the court knows, Judge Jackson found that was waived. Even if it wasn't waived, I think that a close reading of Mr. Clement's brief shows that the liberty interest really doesn't add anything to the property claim. The property claim, Judge Wilkins, you asked a question about, was there this concession made at the district court? It was, but even beyond that, it continues.
I read the transcript, and I don't think that it was. But
but on their brief on appeal, Your Honor, it is clear that Mr. Clement is indeed still arguing, it's several times in his brief, is arguing that it doesn't matter. The property interest is the same whether it's before or after the transaction takes place. We think that's very important, because what that means is, the argument is, two Chinese business executives have a constitutional right to come to the United States and purchase property. So even before there's a purchase, they have a constitutional right.
But I read the transcript. That's not even close to what I think it was Mr. Din said below. He said that our argument would be the same if you gave us this process before we bought the property or after we bought the property, in the sense that the procedural violation would be the same,
right?
I.e., we wouldn't know what the problem was that we needed to address.
Right. And the process, the 2.2 responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, the process is different, because remember, CFIUS, Congress set up a mechanism whereby you can go to the government before the transaction, so before you've incurred major costs, and you can say, is this going to be a problem? Can we talk, etc.? And so it's very difficult to see what property right you might have for foreign business executives to say, we have a constitutional right to come to the United States, purchase property here, and we know we can talk to the agency even in advance of that. But in fact,
but I still don't understand why that affects the property interest. This statute, as I understand it, allows you to have that decision made either on the front end or on the back end. So if you can do it either way, how does that affect whether you have a property interest?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, this court said in the Gandera opinion that's cited in Mr. Clement's brief, said there is no constitutional right for aliens to come in to the United States to purchase property. So right away, this court has said there is no constitutional right.
But it's different saying there isn't a constitutional right to do that than saying if you've done it, you might have a due process right before we can take it away.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's where the Dames and Moore decision, I think, is directly on point here from the Supreme Court, because if they obtained any constitutional right, it was at all times conditional. Just as in Dames and Moore, it was U.S. citizens who obtained attachment against Iranian property, which then the president in a later order wiped out.
But isn't there a difference between having a right to compensation under the Fifth Amendment, which is what Dames and Moore was about, and a right to due process.
Actually, Your Honor, I believe that Dames and Moore was not simply about compensation. They said the president had acted improperly. He couldn't do this. Remember, a takings action is when the government acts properly and you're entitled to compensation. In Dames and Moore, they were saying the president could not do what he did, and the Supreme Court said he could because whatever property rights had been obtained were at all times conditional. And that's exactly true here. Remember, Congress set up this process. You can ask the government for permission, or you, as Your Honor is pointing out, you can take a gamble. You can say, you know what, I'm going to go forward and do this anyway, but you obviously have to know you're on notice. And indeed, the Treasury Department told Rawls that they were on notice, so they knew the president could later nix the transaction. So that's a key part of the property right here. At all times, when Rawls moved forward with their transaction, they knew that the president could invoke national security. And let's get to that, the national security aspects here. Remember, what we're talking about is Chinese business executives who want to construct and operate a wind farm, tall towers, windmills, adjacent to a United States Navy weapons, training, and testing site. And indeed, some of the wind farm property is actually going to be on restricted property where they're restricted access because of overflights. So this isn't some wild and crazy situation that somebody could think of. How could there possibly be a national security interest? We're talking about constructing tall towers adjacent to a United States weapons training.
But there were four sets of wind farms, three of which were not in the restricted airspace, right?
I believe that is correct, but they're directly adjacent to. There's a map in the joint appendix. You can see they're directly adjacent to. So, and none of this is in dispute. Judge Wilkins, you asked about whether the district court had gone outside the complaint. As Mr. Clement correctly answered you, none of the facts that Judge Jackson relied on were in any way disputed. And in fact, Rawls itself went outside the four corners of the complaint in district court. This was just accepted by everybody.
Aren't there some other foreign-owned wind farms, though, I thought, in this area?
I don't think the record reflects, but yes is the answer. There are some. The wind farms vary in how close and how far away they are. And also, obviously, the president's determination is a very fact-specific one. It depends on every CFIUS determination, actually, is very fact-specific.
How do we know that?
Because if you look at the record of CFIUS actions over the years, this is the kind of thing the factors that CFIUS is supposed to take into account make clear that it involves specific things like is the country the nationality of the individuals involved, how is it reacting vis-a-vis the United States, what type of industry is involved, what type of facility, et cetera. That's in the list of the factors that CFIUS
is. But doesn't that cut against your argument that the president's discretion is absolute? It sounds as if there are actually factors that they're looking at.
Yes, there are factors, but Your Honor, remember the statute says as appropriate. It says specifically as appropriate. So the president may take these into account, and in fact, he may take others into account. The fact that the president
So your argument is that this is that these factors can be trumped just by this language that as appropriate. So even if those factors weren't there, the president could do it?
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. And in the realm of national security, we obviously rely on the president's judgment. And as Mr. Clement said, he's not challenging the merits. He is not asking this court, quite properly, he's not asking this court to review the bottom line conclusion made by the president. What he is saying is, my clients should have had access to the president, and they should have had the president explain to them what he was thinking so that they could respond. Now, Obviously, one of the main problems with that is if we're dealing with national security, as I mentioned, in this record there is classified information. This is not shocking or surprising. And this court has made very clear that it is non-justiciable. The courts cannot second-guess the president, but also there wouldn't be any access by Mr. Clement's clients to the classified material. So then that goes into the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing. You know, in the Supreme Court there said, and this court has applied many times, we have to figure out, is the process that's being claimed, how important would it be vis-a-vis the other interests involved? Well, here we obviously have a situation where national security is that's the heart of this. And so there's often going to be classified information that is not, under any circumstances, going to be shared with the applicants. So further process still would not get you material that's at the very heart of the case.
But let's talk about at the kind of CFIUS stage, because it appears to me pretty clear from the complaint and even clear from the statement of issues, issue number 3, which is that whether the CFIUS orders violate the Constitution and the Administrative Procedure Act, that they say that part of their claim is due process during that phase of the procedure. So there may be classified materials, there may be unclassified materials. You don't have a situation of the president and I guess executive privilege. So why isn't the analysis different at that stage, the Matthews v. Eldridge analysis different at that stage, and why doesn't at least, if they were permitted access to the unclassified information, why couldn't that potentially affect the outcome or improve, I guess, the reliability of the outcome?
And, Your Honor, I don't wish to be misunderstood. Your question in itself has an answer. It is different. I'm not arguing that it's not different. The process before CFIUS is obviously very different from process before the president because we have the process arguments because it is the president. The answer is the CFIUS process is moot. It's just like, I suppose, in Waterman Steamship, where there the Supreme Court said there was even a statute providing for review of an order by the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board at the time. But the Supreme Court said, no, because what the board is doing then went to the president. So the decision is made by the president, and therefore there's no review of the CAB because they're not the final decision maker. The president is the final decision maker. So here, the president, in his decision, he actually, not surprisingly, he revoked what CFIUS had done. Now, as Judge Henderson's question asked, this is exceedingly rare in the entire history of CFIUS. Presidents have issued orders like this on only 2 occasions. So it's rare, but when the president acts, any action by CFIUS becomes irrelevant.
Well, so you're saying that if this Court of Appeals has de novo review over a district court, then the district court could just hear from one side and not the other below and issue an order, but because we have de novo review, that alleged violation of due process would be moot, it would be irrelevant?
No, Your Honor. And as Your Honor has pointed out, obviously if something unfair happens below and only one party gets heard, if both parties are supposed to be heard, that would be different. Now, remember, by the way, here, CFIUS, there was lots of process. Remember, and Judge Jackson points that out, there was give and take. they met, were asked a whole series of questions by CFIUS, so there was give and take. The difference, though, the only key thing is, I think in Your Honor's hypothetical, is if somebody then said, I want review of the district court's action, you would say, why? The Court of Appeals has now acted. That's the operative judgment. Now, you could say the Court of Appeals process was affected by what happened in the district court, But here, remember, this is, the matter is presented
to... But he's not asking for review of CFIUS. He's just saying, in the future, I would just like a meaningful opportunity to participate and respond at the CFIUS stage.
Right.
They're not asking for substantive review of the CFIUS action.
And again, first of all, there you would have the same problem. One key part is the same, whether it's the president or CFIUS, which is classified material is not going to be turned over. So the likelihood that further process is going to lead to an explanation of why this transaction raises a threat to national security is not going to be taken care of by further process for the CFIUS. But as I say, there was lots of give and take with CFIUS. But again, bottom line is the any actions by CFIUS are moot because they've been now overtaken by a determination by the president. And remember, the president can look at or choose not to look at whatever he wishes. He has total discretion there, which is not going to be reviewable by the courts. Now, Mr. Clement said, but what about the capable of repetition part? And we said, you know, this court has determined that you have to show a reasonable likelihood that this precise situation is going to happen to you again. Well, indeed, there has been further dealings between Rawls and CFIUS, and CFIUS actually has approved Rawls' wind farm project. So CFIUS posts this. So CFIUS has indeed, there have been transactions where Rawls was not subjected to any type of presidential order. So we think the likelihood of this happening again, that Rawls has come nowhere near meeting the test before this court, we're going to get into very difficult and serious constitutional questions about national security and ordering the president to provide various procedures, or even ordering CFIUS to provide various procedures, when there isn't a no showing has been made that there is a reasonable likelihood of this happening again.
I know that you're already over your time, but I want to go back to something you said because I want to make sure that I understand your argument. I think you said that language, as appropriate, sort of trumps all of the specific factors and gives the president absolute discretion. Could Congress enact a statute that used some language like that, as appropriate, unrelated to national security, and therefore basically trump the constitutional requirement for due process?
Your Honor, I think maybe my answer was slightly different. Let me try. When Congress says as appropriate, it lists factors that we looked at, but as appropriate, so meaning as the situation demands, as the whoever the decision maker is, whether it's the secretary, some cabinet secretary or the president, there to determine is it appropriate? Because as Mr. Clement properly pointed out, a batch of the factors have nothing to do with this specific situation. So it would be mm-hmm. as appropriate to the specific situation. The statute also says that the process can take into account other factors. This isn't a limited list by any means.
Okay.
So
your point really is that as appropriate language means it determines which factors you might look at. You don't have to look at all of them. But nevertheless, the president's discretion is cabined by those factors it is appropriate to consider.
No, I don't think so. I don't think at the end of the day the president is cabined by those, because the statute also says that the president can consider other factors. And if I may add one other point on this, Your Honor, because this goes to the argument, that it seems to me, of reviewability. The Supreme Court in Dalton versus Specter looked at the reviewability of base closure decisions. And there, the congressional reports made clear a series of factors that were to be taken into account by the Secretary of Defense and the President as they made their decisions. So it wasn't as if they were making their decisions just, you know, whatever I feel like today. But the Supreme Court nevertheless said there's no judicial review. It's in the discretion of, in that situation, the Secretary of Defense and the President. So the same thing here, even though there are factors.
I understand we can't review the decision.
Yes.
The statute says that. But the question is, can we look at a constitutional claim that says the process wasn't adequate?
Right. And as Your Honor knows, we argue, as for instance in the McBride case, no, you don't. But we fortunately have an alternative argument, which Judge Jackson accepted. Even if you do, the process here was appropriate under these circumstances.
I did want to ask you, I know you haven't thrown in the towel on 2170E about the justiciability, about our jurisdiction to even hear this. And is there anything, I just wanted you to be heard on that. Are you resting on your brief, or do you want to be heard on the clear, and, for instance, the clear and convincing evidence you've got to come up with and so forth?
Certainly, Your Honor, I'd be happy to address that. First of all, we rely on the wording of the statute itself, which is reprinted at A12 of the addendum to our brief. So section, it says, the actions of the president and the findings of the president shall not be subject to judicial review. Now, as Mr. Clement properly pointed out, the Supreme Court and this Court have said there can be a presumption of judicial review of constitutional questions. But as this Court held in McBride, that is a presumption. It is not a definitive factor. We look at the wording of the statute, and that's very plain. Now, it doesn't say, and this also includes any constitutional issues, but that's why McBride is very important. The statute there didn't provide anything along those lines either.
But isn't that sui generis because you had Article III judges reviewing it?
You did have Article III judges, except, Your Honor, I think that the concurring opinion of Judge Tatel in that case is very important because Judge Tatel pointed out that review by Article III judges, remember, they were not acting as a court. And he pointed out that meant there would be no further review. It would be very different. Article III judges acting as the judicial council is quite different from them acting as a court. Mm-hmm. So this Court made that ruling of no judicial review, knowing that no court could review Judge McBride's claims. In addition, again, very much like McBride, what we have here is the legislative history shows Congress was very focused on review by itself. Congress provided for numerous reporting requirements, and there's one factor about that that I hope you'll focus on because it is quite unusual. In the reporting requirements, CFIUS has to report to Congress about each individual transaction. Congress even limited the delegation of who would make that report. Congress said, we want to hear from only one of a couple of people. Don't start delegating this down. We want to hear directly. So Congress said, knowing that this is an area where Congress has, since the beginning of the Republic, heavily regulated foreign investment in the United States, and knowing there are important balances to be made here, we want foreign investment, but we don't want to endanger national security, Congress said, we will be the ones who review this. So that, in combination with the very clear language of the statute, is the basis of our argument.
Well, let me ask you about the complaint that's being held up, where you're asking, that is, the United States is asking the district court to enforce the divestment.
Yes.
I take it, looking at the prayer for relief, there's not to be any review of the order itself, just simply enforce this order.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. That is correct. And that is that has been stayed by the district court.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Why don't you take a couple minutes, Mr. Clement?
Thank you. I'd endeavor to actually make 4 points. One is that Mr. Letter starts with saying that we're challenging the president's action, and therefore the only thing we'll take is a meeting with the president or notice from the president. We take it as understood that when you're challenging the executive's action, due process may be provided by subordinate government officials, and we certainly would expect that's what would happen here if we had gotten first due process from CFIUS and then the unclassified version of CFIUS's report to the president with an opportunity to respond. All of that, I think, would have sufficed under due process. But so it's just, I think, a red herring to say that we're, just because we're challenging the president's action, that that's all we'll take. I also think it would be kind of a dangerous precedent because, as I understand their argument, what they can do is they can take a deprivation even of my property. They can make that final deprivation for the president. They can say, you know, you can't review the president. You can't meet with him because he's the president. No, by the way, if you want to see what went to the president, we're going to invoke the presidential privilege. That can't be the way it works in this country. It just can't. If they delegate something to the president, that's all well and good. But just as we understand that subordinate officials will actually discharge most of the actual responsibilities, we also expect those subordinate officials to comply with the Constitution and give the processes to do. I also think if you put the two parts of their argument together, you see why it's so dangerous. It's, well, the CFIUS, maybe you don't think they gave you due process, but that's moot. And the president, well, you can't get due process from him because he's the president. That can't be right, as I think some of the questions underscored. On Dames and Moore, I think the right thing to focus on, this is my second point, on Dames and Moore, the right thing to focus on is not the attachment, but at the very end of the opinion, the Supreme Court talks about the underlying claims. And the problem with the attachment for due process purposes is that's a creature of federal law. So the federal government can make that contingent in ways that may affect the property right. But the claim, the underlying claims that were taken away from the litigants, it was common ground in Dames and Moore that those were property interests. And our property rights here to go to and fro from this property, to build the structures and the like, those are the state law processes, property rights rather, that have clearly been interfered with by federal action, and that federal action just has to comply with the due process clause. That's the way that it's supposed to work. Now, the third point is the closest thing we've gotten to an explanation from the government as to what's really going on here is Mr. Letters pointing out that this is a Navy base, it's a Navy Air Force base, and these are tall towers. Okay, but that's exactly the, if that's really the gravamen of the concerns, boy, do we have great answers. Because in 2010 and 2011, we went to the people who are concerned about tall towers around flying planes, the FAA, and they made a formal determination of no hazard for the sighting of these plants. And then if you look at Joint Appendix 79, which is the part in the Joint Appendix where you see the map of this Air Force base with the, or Naval base with the various wind farms, you know, you'd expect, based on concerns about tall towers and wind farms, you'd expect to see a restrictive airspace and no wind towers in that restrictive airspace and then maybe some ringed around it. What you see is some towers actually situated in the restricted airspace, and then you see, you know, as many wind farms as you see on a trip to Spain all around this thing. And what it suggests to me is that can't be what's really going on here. But I sure would have liked an opportunity in real time to have made a presentation. And again, you know, could that have back and forth? We also had a back and forth with the Navy themselves where we agreed, before the CFIUS process, where we agreed to move some of these. That might have resulted in a process where the three projects that aren't in restricted airspace go forward and we give up on the one in restricted airspace. But that's all the kind of give and take you'd expect in a process that affords due process. My last point is just to be responsive to this last discussion about the preclusion of judicial review. I think the McBride case really is sui generis. I think we'd settle for due process before the, you know, Judicial Discipline Committee if somebody wants to give us access to those Article III judges. We're just looking for some due process from somebody. Judge Tatel dissented in part in that opinion, so I think the fact that he had a different view of what the judges could consider is what led to his partial dissent, but certainly the majority reached its sui generis conclusion there on the express assumption that the Discipline Committee could fully consider the constitutional questions. And then the last thing is, if you're going to read legislative history, I think you have to read it closely, because it is true that the legislative history emphasizes the role of Congress and oversight, but that's the legislative history explaining why it's okay to preclude judicial review of the statutory claims. But what this Court's cases and the Supreme Court's cases ask for is something that indicates in the legislative history that even constitutional claims are off the table. And I don't think you see that. And if I could just leave you with a quote from Judge Sentell in a majority opinion, this is the NCRI case. The idea that the government's going to provide some indication of what's going on to Congress, I think actually ultimately hurts them, because that actually shows that you can't actually articulate what's going on to somebody. And it doesn't make any sense for that to go to a party other than the regulated party. So as Judge Sentell said for the court in NCRI, neither is it apparent how notice by the Article II branch, that would be my friend Mr. Letter, that Article II branch of government to representatives of the Article I branch can substitute for notice to the person deprived. And that's the basic problem here. The person deprived of their property has not been given notice and therefore no opportunity to be heard. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you.